everyone, and welcome to this month's podcast. With me is Disha Kopreux. She is the CEO of Redland Roses, and we're surrounded by roses today. And I'm so happy to have you here, Disha.
Thank you, Jerry. Likewise.
I think we met, I think a couple of years back, but then I think we've always had informal conversations. But now I've gotten to know you on such another level. First of all, let's get to the fact that you're a Kenyan girl. Well, you didn't grow up in Kenya, you grew up in Tanzania. Tell us about how you grew up in your childhood.
Thanks, Jerry. I had a very unique childhood. It was not just in one place. I was born and brought up in Nairobi until the age of 7.
Yeah.
Then we moved to Tanzania, where I did elementary school. From there, high school in Australia, on to university in the UK. I've grown up pretty much all over the world.
Yeah. And you're married to someone who's French.
That's right. Married to a French man, mm-hmm. Johan Kopreux, whom I met when we were studying at Harvard Business School.
But the interesting thing is that you also went to French school when you were young. So I guess it's a natural progression.
Yeah, some would say that it came full circle.
Yeah.
I think an unintended consequence, probably not planned by my mum and dad at the time. But yes, that's very true, Jerry. I went to the Lycée Denis Diderot de Nairobi, where I did école maternelle or kindergarten.
Yeah.
And that was the journey of learning the French language.
Yeah, amazing. And being able to converse. You also did a homestay in France as well.
That's right. Yeah. When I finished high school in Australia, I did a 6-month homestay in the town of Toulon just before starting university. Yeah.
So everything comes full circle at some point. The fact that you work at Redland Roses and the fact that your family is also in agriculture, it just shows that coincidences just don't happen.
Yeah.
How did you move from Redland from being a family of agriculturalists to then Redland Roses?
So very good question, Jerry. I would always like to describe my life as a sequential logic, but it's not what happened. I think that if I was to describe life, it's happened not in a linear pattern, but it's kind of, right now at least, the position that I have at Redlands Roses is the culmination of the experiences that I've had and the influences. Okay.
Yeah.
So how did we get to Redlands from the family business? Well, the family business gave me a footing in agriculture and an inspiration and an exposure to agriculture, okay, with an uncle being a horticulturalist and a floriculturalist, and my dad, who is an agricultural commodities trader.
Yeah.
And both of them started their career in Kenya and, you know, and have grown from here. So the influence was there from a very young age, okay? When I was young, I still recall going to Naivasha and picking strawberries, which were at the time grown on soil.
Yeah.
Today, you now have strawberries grown in hydroponics. Those memories remain with you. Today, when I go to Naivasha with my 2 French Kenyan Indian girls, you know, those memories come back and the exposures and the experiences that I also want to impart on them. The second is the career decisions that I made. So I started my career in agriculture in large scale commercial farming. I then eventually went on to work at a large multinational called Syngenta in seed. So I got experiences in operations, but within the agricultural sector, you know, at different points in my time, in different countries and in different roles. And so I would describe my position at Redlands as the culmination of the influence and the experience and, the operations, the experience that
you've gotten. But I think that the most interesting thing is when I was reading about you, I thought that you were working in a family business, but actually that's not true. So you took the less trodden path. You decided to go out on your own and not join the family business and then go out on your own and try something different. Why did you decide to do that?
I decided to take some risk at some point in my life. I think as an individual, it's always trying new things. I mean, I was the only kid in my generation coming from an Asian community that was in the French school.
Yeah.
It was so amazing and unique for me to be able to speak a language that nobody else understood.
Yeah.
In a similar note, nobody did a homestay for 6 months in France, or nobody had this desire to leave Australia and their family and go and study in the UK, because I thought it was far more fun to study in the UK. I think there was a sense already within me of adventure, okay, and to try new things. And so what happened was at the time that, you know, I worked with the family business immediately after graduating from undergraduate.
Yeah.
And then I went to business school. And at business school, I met my husband, who I would say was a capitalist. But also I was at school with very ambitious, you know, friends, you know, each trying their hand at entrepreneurship in the tech startup world. You know, I talked to you earlier about a friend of mine who was one of the first employees at Uber, right? And look at where Uber is right now. Mm-hmm. And so that also is a motivating factor, right? And, you know, it's not just necessarily that the older you get, you know, your risk appetite reduces, but I think it's also a function of the environment that you're in. And in the environment that I was in, everyone was taking different risks. My husband, who is a McKinsey consultant, decided he's going to go and work in football and then eventually go and become an entrepreneur, right? So you eventually that influence rubs off on you.
Yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So at that point, I decided, okay, I'm not going to go back yet to Kenya or to Tanzania. I'm going to go and explore what the world out there has for me. It's very scary, I would say, when you have a nice safety net and a nice carved out ready, you know, life path for you. But I think the adventure in me basically tipped the scale in favor of...
But I mean, and then look where you are. I would say if we were going to have like a real conversation about the fact that you're an Asian Kenyan woman and the fact that you're a CEO of a business, there aren't many women that you see, especially in agriculture, being CEOs. You wouldn't necessarily think of yourself as, you know, the traditional path of an Asian woman in Kenya, although there are some very powerful women CEOs, obviously. But it's that history. I think what I'm learning from you is that there's a history of not following the convention and then doing something that's different. Just so that we're clear, when you were younger, did you think you were going to go into the family business? Did you want to do something else? Did you want to be something else? Or was it just agriculture and horticulture all the time?
No, I actually wanted to be a doctor.
Really?
Yes, because in the Asian community, I would say that there were three coveted professions.
There are still, aren't there?
I think not anymore, Jerry. Okay. I think things are changing. And I think that's a function of exposure, right? And of, I think, the generations of at least within my community, the Asian community, not being as, you know... As the generations grow, there's different exposures, there's different schooling. Now we've got the internet, right? The vision of what your career could be has expanded manifold.
Yeah.
Okay. I'm sure you'll still find, you know, some traditionalists, but I think by and large, I'd say the community is really starting to think more broadly. Things like gap years have become like the norm, right? Things like work experience to really figure out what you want to do before you engage yourself in a 3-year degree at university or, you know, those have now become the norm. Right?
And not doing the traditional family business.
Exactly.
Doing something else.
Mm-hmm. I think that too, the expectation of, you know, immediately joining a family business no longer exists like it used to. Okay.
Yeah.
Family businesses now realize that they have options to institutionalize, bring on external shareholders, and that they don't necessarily need to hold, you know, need to obligate rather their children to come and join the business. So you're more freer in your
And I think it's good for everyone who has had a safety net to even try something. You know, I didn't have a safety net and I know how it's like to, you know, make sure that you're always striving. And I've done the traditional career, you know, being a lawyer and all of that. So as a CEO of a business, what do you think it is that you bring to it that is the high value?
So let me give you a bit of context on Red Lands Roses, okay? So it's a business where we employ 1,000 people, okay? Majority of the people that we employ are what I would describe as individuals that come from the base of the pyramid, okay? Who otherwise would have no other option in terms of formal employment, okay? And for me, my ability to connect with these individuals, okay, my colleagues, is probably the biggest strength that I bring to Redlands today. Mm-hmm. This comes from, you know, my exposure even as a child growing up, you know, with my dad, with my uncle, going, you know, to the farms, working with people, traveling different countries in Africa, understanding how people are and being able to relate to them on a human-to-human level, I think that that's the biggest strength that I bring to Redlands.
Yeah. I mean, that's amazing. And you told me that, you explained to me that when you came into Redland Roses, you were actually a first-time CEO. How did you know how to navigate that, you know, really difficult trajectory, right?
Yeah. I'm always going to be grateful for a couple of things, Jerry. I'm grateful for the fact that Adenia Partners, the shareholder of Redlands, took a bet on me. I believe I had the fundamentals to be a CEO, but I didn't have CEO written anywhere on my CV.
Yeah.
The second thing is sponsorship from mentors. Okay. I think that this is very critical as you step in and you position yourself for success. Okay. And in my case, I actually had two individuals, the first being Isabel Spindler, the founder of Redlands Roses, who effectively built Redlands Roses from scratch, okay, to a 28-hectare farm. And she imparted in me, not herself also having come from any formal business education, how to run a business, how to manage people, how to run the different functional areas of a business, both commercially, technically, how to plug in the gaps where you don't know how to answer certain questions. And she really taught me everything that, you know, that I needed to know to get up to speed. And she did that with patience, okay? And the second one is Alexis Code, who is the managing partner of Adenia Partners, who effectively has mentored me through this journey of stepping up, understanding how to manage people at senior level, and already also provided the structure for me to hold myself to account every month. You know, we have these monthly Stratcom meetings or strategic committee meetings where I need to talk about the financial performance of the business, any operational challenges, and then deliver on what I promise, you know, on a monthly basis. And I believe that that allowed me to be on track and to slowly get to where I needed to be. I think the last point that I want to make is no one is born a CEO, okay? You basically build yourself into a CEO through, you know, different things. So as I said, mentorship, structure, and then the last thing is that you can't, it's hard work, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
And I would describe myself today as an operational CEO. I know most of the areas of my business, whether it's maintenance, whether it's technical, whether it's pest and disease management. And I've taken an interest and an effort. I spend today 6 days a week on the farm.
Yeah.
But that's a commitment that I've chosen to make. And it's a balance that works for me and my family right now as I'm, you know, climbing up the CEO path.
I mean, you know, it's easy to see why they would have taken a gamble on you, because I think you really do connect with people very easily from what I can see. How does Disha as a person, you know, deal with failure, deal with falling short? And then how do you then also deal with, you know, celebrating your successes?
Really, really great question, Jerry. You know, I often wonder, you know, a CEO is not supposed to be strong all the time. There are highs and there are lows in a business, okay? And I do experience the lows. And what I've come up with are coping mechanisms to deal with those lows, okay? Things will not always go as per plan. Resignations will happen, you know? Unexpected problems will come.
Yeah.
Problems that you've never dealt with and don't even know how to get your head around. Structuring, understanding, and then solving.
Yeah.
I have coping mechanisms in that whenever a problem does present, you know, I take a walk, go outside in the farm and take a long walk, breathe in and out. That really works for me. I've also invested in sport very early in the morning before I go.
Really? Which one?
Boxing.
Really?
Yeah, to take out a lot of
I told you were small and mighty.
Move like a butterfly, sting like a bee.
Yeah.
Actually, if that was a quote, that would be mine.
Okay, we can change it.
But yeah, I have coping mechanisms. But the biggest, I actually want to mention something. I'm part of YPO.
Yeah.
Okay, and I'm part of a forum group. And you know, what I've learned through YPO is that every leader is going to face problems, whether professional or personal, right? And what makes you a good leader is the resilience that you have in the face of these problems. The problems don't just go away and then it's happily ever after, because that's a misconception. problems will always come at a rate that you cannot control.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And what you can control is your mindset and how you deal with those problems. I would say that in the early part of my journey as a CEO, dealing with those problems was very tough because I couldn't understand when they would stop. Today, I'm in control. Today, I'm able to take any problem head on and say, cool, I'm going to deal with this. Okay. On top of that, as I said earlier, we have some coping mechanisms as leaders, and mine is to go out for a walk, breathe in and out, do sport in the morning. And very recently, I started doing Afrobeats dancing.
Are you serious?
And I've stayed true
to
that.
Where is this Afrobeats dancing?
Now I have a coach that comes home.
I love that.
And he teaches me how to...
Can I join?
Of course you can. Come and join me.
Yeah, that's so cool. Okay. So I guess, you know, the other thing about, you know, dealing with problems or even knowing how to cope, do you always have to look over your shoulder or do you just say, I'll take it each day as it comes?
So you should control what you need to control in a business. Mm-hmm. Okay. And in my case, I've now built up a team. That was one of my contributions to Red Lansrose is as we transitioned from a family owned business.
Mm-hmm.
to a professionally managed company. I had to build out a team, okay? We've come also so I would describe that as, you know, firstly building up a team, but also change management.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
The style of management that I encountered when I joined Redlands was one of, you know, a top-down micromanagement. It was a management style that worked for the business at the time, but I knew that that wasn't going to be able to, I knew that that style of management wouldn't work for a much larger company.
Yeah.
Because obviously we had to deliver on a 60% growth for the business. Okay?
Oh gosh, that's a lot.
That's right. So we went from 28 hectares to 43 hectares.
Oh wow.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So I knew that I had to build a team and I needed to create managers that were accountable.
Yeah.
Okay. So today, to give you an analogy, I've got managers who are owners and are able to deal with the problems that come up within their departments. That liberates my time to look at the more macro problems that could impact the company.
Yeah.
Now, you can foresee certain things and you can control them. But for those that you can't, you just take them as they come.
Yeah.
Yeah. But there's no panic involved. There's no stress involved. At least much less than there was.
Less if you're looking over your shoulder all the time.
Correct.
Yeah.
Correct.
All right.
And if you've got a well-run machine, you don't need to look over your shoulder. You've been able to hedge a lot of the things that could impact your business.
Yeah. Right? But you've clearly been extremely successful. What does the 9-to-5 look like? Is it a 9-to-5?
So firstly, I'd like to clarify, it's not a 9-to-5.
Okay.
And it's not a Monday to Friday. It's, I would say, 7-to-7.
7-to-7.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And I would say it's a Monday to Saturday.
Yeah.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
But again, that's the time commitment I've chosen to commit to this business because I believe that this is what's allowing me to grow, but also allowing the business to thrive.
Mm.
Eventually, I'd like to figure out a system where we can have more sustainable working hours. And as I said, this is in the process of happening now as I basically have managers who are operational and owners.
Yeah.
And that's also the reason why I can be here today to have a catch up with you, Jerry, is because I have really good managers.
I mean, you asked me why I started the podcast, and this is actually why. Because none of us can be experts at managing businesses. None of us know exactly what to do. And I think it's really good to understand different management styles and different ways of coping with the stresses that are put on us as, you know, as leaders in our businesses. What do you find most rewarding about your work? What do you think I've done this and it's amazing, or we've done this and it's amazing?
It all goes back to people.
Mm.
Okay. When you watch people and you see visibly that they're content to come to work.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That's the impact that I've had. And for me, that means that spending that 7-to-7, Monday to Saturday, is worth it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
What is it that Redland Roses does that's different from other flower farms? I know it's a boutique flower farm.
That's right. So in the industry, well, within the ecosystem of flower farms, Redlands, as you rightly said, is a boutique farm. We're one of the smallest farms.
Yeah.
They probably
even with 43 hectares.
Correct.
I mean, I guess it's because I don't have a perception of what that is.
So let me give you some perception, right? So we have about 4,000 hectares mm-hmm. Of flowers in Kenya. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So 43 hectares represents like 1%.
Gosh.
Okay, but we have a very strong brand name for what we do globally in the world where we sell our flowers.
Yeah. Okay. What is the highest market?
I would say Europe too.
Europe, okay.
Yeah. Right. Western Europe is a very lucrative market. Eastern Europe is starting to very much pick up.
Okay.
And Central Asia.
Places. Okay.
We would like to also crack the US, but currently we're facing challenges on freight costs.
Okay. Okay.
But I believe that the product has a unique enough differentiating factor that we could eventually go to the US at some point.
Okay. So growth strategy all the way.
Correct. So in terms of what makes Redlands different to other farms is that we are, you know, amongst, you know, we are alongside a lot of our other flower farm colleagues, we subscribe to the CBA, collective bargaining agreement with the Kenya Plantation and Agricultural Workers Union. Okay. We adhere very strictly to the standards of that CBA in so far as employment terms, welfare terms. Okay. But we have borrowed quite a lot. And I'm going to talk here about Isabel Spindler, the founder of the farm, who brought a lot of her French, you know, welfare system background in how she chose to set up the farm when she founded it. Mm-hmm. Okay. And it all goes back to her wanting to ensure that whoever came to work at the farm came happy to work. And could come to work with peace of mind and could have at least a good quality of life.
Yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And what that meant for her and how she translated that into benefits was that she offered private medical insurance. So today, all our employees are able to get, you know, private level medical care at the cost of the company at Nazareth Ruiru or Nazareth Kiambu Hospital. Okay. Not only just for themselves, but for their spouse and up to two children. This is unheard of.
It is unheard of, yeah.
Okay. The second thing was education was incredibly important to her. Mm-hmm. So today we finance up to two kids going to school.
Wow, for every employee.
For every single employee. Okay. We also provide hot subsidized meals.
Gosh.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And then we also provide bicycles for every single permanent employee so that they could commute to and from work. And majority of our employees live within, I would say, a 4 to 6 kilometer radius of the farm. So that provides them with a way to improve their health, do some exercise as they commute to and from work.
But I mean, the thing about it is that farming and agriculture, the sector, gets really bad reputation. And I think this is a great example of something that is completely against the trend. So, I mean, amazing for you and that you've continued to do that even now.
I want to mention one thing, actually, Jerry, just to emphasize the point around, you know, social responsibility.
Yeah.
Okay. As an industry and as a farm, we're audited. Okay. So we subscribe to standards.
Yeah.
Okay. And these standards are becoming increasingly important even for our customers. Okay. So as a farm, for instance, we follow the Kenya Silver Standard. Okay. It's a standard that is part of the Floral Sustainability Initiative. It's a basket of different types of certifications, of which Kenya Flower Council Silver Standard is one of them. Mm. Okay. When you subscribe to this standard, you make a firm commitment around your responsibility to the environment, to your people, and to good agricultural practices. Okay. And as a farm, we were already doing this, but now we're formally recognized because we've got this standard and we're audited every year in our compliance to these standards. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I think that the Kenya Flower Council does a pretty stellar job of ensuring our compliance to these standards and to make sure that we can continue, you know.
I mean, that's really good. You sit on the board of the Kenya Flower Council, so I guess you have that knowledge.
Yeah, I do.
Yeah, but and I think that's good for the flower industry in general because of how much it impacts people's livelihoods here and also abroad, right?
Yep, that's right.
I wanted to ask you, does technology and you know, AI come into the business at the moment? There's a lot of talk of how AI is impacting a lot of businesses. Is that anything that you guys are talking about?
Yes, absolutely, Jerry. So, you know, everyone's using as of late, ChatGPT.
Yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And what I've seen in the company is, I'll give you an example, sales executives using ChatGPT to process orders.
Okay.
Okay. To get orders in a very unstructured format and asking ChatGPT to structure those orders so they can be quickly inputted into our sales software system.
Yeah.
Before, that process could have taken 2 or 3 hours.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's time saved.
Yeah.
I can see the sales executives using ChatGPT to write emails in different languages to different customers.
I love that.
Okay. I can see us using ChatGPT to structure processes.
Yeah.
We're a very process-driven firm. Mm-hmm. Okay. But before we get to ChatGPT, which is what we see happen currently, is that I want to really make a point around the fact that Redlands Roses, when I found it, you know, and when I entered the business, as a very data-driven business.
Yeah.
Okay. In the sense that we're collecting data from everywhere. What's happening in the field, what varieties were harvested, what losses we incurred, the reasons for those losses. You know, as they enter the packing hall, how many bunches of any specific variety? So today we've got Giulietta here.
That's your favorite.
That's my favorite. That's my absolute favorite. Yeah. And then we've got Muriel Lace.
Lovely.
So, you know, 2 different varieties out of a pool of 200.
Yeah.
You need to keep a track.
200 varieties.
200 varieties. Okay. You need to have traceability of which greenhouses they came from.
Yeah.
If somebody claims on this variety, a claim is when there's a certain problem on a variety at the end destination and a customer wants a refund for what they've paid for, you can actually trace where that variety came from, what the problem she faced, and then you can do something about it.
Yeah. Okay? So they had been collecting that data.
Always.
And it must have been manual. Somehow automated.
So actually we had like an archaic scanning system to collect all that data and to computerize it in database.
Okay.
And today I can also tell you what the productivity and the quality efficiencies of anyone in my packing hall.
Wow.
Right?
Like the speed of which they're working.
The speed at which they're working, the quality of the product that they're pulling out. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. What that meant as a data-driven individual was that when I came in, I had a data playground. And that was also one of the reasons I was able to sort of grasp all that data and understand the operations of this business.
Yeah, yeah.
Now what we're doing is we're going one step further and we're looking at that data and converting into business intelligence dashboards.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So that's how we're leveraging already existing data, continuing to build upon that data reserve and converting it into intelligible insights for our managers to now have that data at the click of a finger. But do something about it, right? Take decisions.
Give me an example of something that you can do with that data.
Okay, so let's take an example, right? On any given day, I can look at the causes of losses.
Okay.
Okay? Mm-hmm. Because we record. So let's talk about a variety like Giulietta. She's grown in a specific greenhouse. Okay? And I'm expecting, from my budget standpoint, a certain yield for Giulietta. Okay? Every day that Giulietta is harvested, she's brought to the packing hall and then the losses start getting recorded based on why she's being rejected, because we'll only export the most perfect stem.
Yeah.
We're not in the business of exporting disease. We can't.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
We can't either.
Yeah.
It looks bad for our reputation. Yeah. It looks bad for the customer. More importantly, you don't want to...
Yeah.
Your product is your reputation, right? So we will be able to sort out at that point in the packing hall the reasons for why we've discarded certain stems. That same exercise also happens in the field.
Okay.
The data clerk will aggregate all that data and input it into the database. Now, I can tell you with a lot of certainty yesterday that we threw away 300 stems of Giulietta, and the key reason was because she's suffering from rotting.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm,
okay?
Mm-hmm.
So that's pretty unique. And I'll tell you that that Giulietta, I know for a fact, she's grown in several greenhouses, but the key greenhouse from which we threw these stems was Greenhouse Delta.
Yeah.
Okay?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So now I'm getting to a point where I'm not guessing the reason for why.
Yes. Yes. If you can be specific.
I can be very specific. Mm-hmm. And now I'm in a position to tell the pest and disease team, hey, guys, what are you doing about this? What's causing the rotting? And they'll then be able to diagnose that the spray that they did was at the wrong time. They did an afternoon spray when it was very sunny.
Yeah.
And that created the damage that we see.
Yeah.
Or that there is a pest called thrips that is affecting her. Okay, so when's the next spray planned? Or what's your strategy to solve that?
I mean, that is so... It's a mixture of technical and, you know, understanding the data and then being able to do something about it. Okay.
Absolutely.
Well, I mean, that's excellent. Yeah. I had a question here on... you don't seem like the loudest person in the room, but I really want to change that. I don't think that's true.
How
do you make sure that your point comes across when it needs to?
Jerry, Dynamite comes in small packages, right? That's what I wanted to tell you.
That's more like a threat. I'm just waiting.
I can get my point across. Yeah. I think I'm the littlest person on this farm.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. No, I can get a point across. This, maybe just to shed some light on this, because you've asked, it doesn't just happen that you can own your space within a room, right? It's again a function of the experiences that you've had. So mom, I want to talk about my mom.
Yeah.
Okay. Mom basically encouraged me to be a good public speaker and to do debating. These are the experiences that I got when I was in Australia. Another influence from my mom is, if you don't like something, you say it.
Yeah.
Don't just keep quiet and mom's not going to solve the problem. That again is like something I'm going to impart onto my girls, mm-hmm. right? The second one was probably, but this was more stressful for me, when I was an MBA candidate at Harvard Business School, all the courses are taught through the case study method, where you've got to read your case and you got to come to class, be prepared to raise your hand and to speak. I think I didn't speak for the first 6 months
because
I was stressed. But eventually you need to speak, otherwise you're not going to be graded correctly and they might kick you out of the school.
Yeah.
You got to make your point. You got to put your hand up. You got to not worry whether it's the right or the wrong answer, and you got to just make your point. And then, of course, now, you know, through, you know, your various, I guess you can't become a CEO eventually if you don't make yourself heard along the way enough for people to see what you can contribute.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
But yeah, I would say it's like a function of things. And now I can make that point.
Maybe the point about this conversation is really that everything comes full circle. And you pull from every life experience that you have.
I agree.
And I think that is your beautiful lesson in that. What message would you give to any woman who is either at less than managerial level and wants to climb at managerial level? How do you think, where does that drive for success? Where do you pull from? How do you make it happen?
Really great question, Jerry. So we have a lot of Gen Zs coming to join us, okay? And the only thing that I can do is I can teach from my experience.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's the textbook way of doing things, but in this case, I've lived that experience. So what I do is I draw from my own experience and I try and impart that on to these young individuals joining our company. So I would boil it down to a couple of things. The first being that when you have a job, appreciate the job and give it your all. And it starts from just the way that you carry yourself in that job, that you show up on time, you leave on time. The absolute basics of a job that if you don't understand, ask, because you don't lose anything by asking and clarifying. You lose by assuming. Continue asking until you really understood what you needed to do, right? And carry yourself consistently. If you say you're going to come at a certain time, come.
Mm-hmm.
Report at that time and ask, what do you need for me to get done? Don't be the person that needs to be chased and followed up. This I would describe as the absolute basics.
Okay. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And I think as part of the basics, I would also say communication. You can be sick. Circumstances can happen. Everything can be understood. But if you don't have clear communication, it makes the relationship with anyone more complicated.
Correct.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Lack of transparency, unreliable, etc.
Yeah.
So number one is, focus on being a consistent, communicating, and reliable person, okay? The second would be to take ownership. I have a really amazing person that works at our company. I believe she's going to go very far in her IT career. And I often reflect on her and I wonder what's making her stand apart is the fact that whether it's an IT job or not, she will be proactive and she'll get the job done. And this is something interesting because, you know, I was watching an interview with Obama and, you know, what I took out of one of the things that he said is that you can't teach attitude. You can teach skills, but you can't teach somebody the attitude of showing up and just getting it done. Be the doer. And this girl, you know, when you look at her, you know, where she's come from and the hardship she'd had to go through, I feel like being the person to back her up and to get her where she needs to be, because she just gets stuff done. And the technical skills, I've no doubt that she'll learn. So get stuff done. And alongside that one is take ownership, care. Don't just do a deliverable for the sake of it. Show that you really took like due effort to get it done, because you cared about the impact of that deliverable on the full picture. I would say that those are the few things I would guide people on.
I wish you'd come and talk to all young people entering, because all of those things are so key for anyone who's entering into the workforce at the moment. So I completely agree with you. What are your personal tips and tricks for doing well that you could impart to someone? Like, for example, do you do checklists? Like, what is it? I know that you're very heavy on the data and very heavy on the analysis of the data. What are your personal tips and tricks that you would like to impart?
So apart from what I've already said, right? Mm-hmm. So let me tell you how I manage my week, right?
Yeah.
Do it the very traditional old-fashioned way. So I keep a list of to-dos.
Yeah.
The only thing now is that we've got IT tools to keep those to-do lists on. And then what I try to do is I list everything that comes up in a week in that list so I don't forget.
I do the list every day. And, you know, it could be adding things, but I rewrite it every day so that I know that everything is still fresh.
Yep, that's correct. And I think I follow pretty much the same approach. And what I do is at the start of every week, I know which priorities I want to focus on because time is limited, right? And I've now got a good sense of my company and its priorities, right? So I'm able to naturally figure out how to prioritize. So second point, prioritization. Okay. And it's a bit simple for me because at the head of the organization, I set the priorities, right? And my priorities are socialized with the board, agreed, and I know what I need to get done, right? You also have to leave time for unexpected things, right? So things can come up and, you know, certain things will have to shift or be moved on to the next week.
Yeah.
So I would say listing down everything that comes your way and then prioritizing. These are two very important skill sets that have allowed me to at least achieve what I needed to get done.
Yeah.
It's not rocket science.
No, it's not. It seems like it.
Exactly.
But it's actually not.
No. Mm-hmm. I used to wonder from afar, like, these guys are succeeding. Like, you know, your role models, how are they succeeding?
Mm-hmm.
I think it's discipline. It's discipline of listing down everything and being consistent. It's the things that I talked about earlier.
Correct.
It's nothing too difficult.
Yeah. During your time at Redland, what has been like the highest of the highs that you've had? Can you tell us?
The highest of the highs.
Apart from the day you were appointed.
I'll tell you, the highest of the highest days was in Christmas last year when we had our annual Christmas party. One of our staff members is a rap singer.
I love that. Okay.
Yeah.
We also have
musician,
a
musician, rap singer.
One of our partners is also a rapper. Yeah.
And that's his side hustle.
Yeah.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And he basically pulled out a song dedicated to me.
I love that. Where is the song?
This song is on YouTube and I'll share it with you. And that was, for me, the moment where I realized, you know, thank you, Dad, for teaching me how to be a human.
Oh, amazing.
And
we have to put a link to this, to the song on.
Yes, of course. There. And in February when they celebrated my birthday in the packing hall.
When is your birthday?
It's on the 4th of Feb.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And my office, because I'm an operations CEO, is with the entire operations team right next to the packing hall.
Yeah.
And I was having a meeting with one of my direct reports, and all of a sudden you hear on the loudspeaker, Disha, oh, Disha, oh, Disha.
Is that the song?
Yes. And I was like, why is this song playing in the packing hall? So we actually have music playing in the packing hall to provide a relaxing environment mm-hmm. for our packing hall artisans to, you know, to bunch all these flowers.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was like, why is that song playing? And then, of course, I was, you know, the suspicion of they probably planned something in the packing hall.
Oh, amazing, Disha. And I'm really glad that we've had this sit down, because I think it's given me an insight as to, you know, you don't necessarily have to follow the beaten path And you can chart your own course and discover so much more about yourself. So thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much, Jerry.
Excellent guest.
I really enjoyed speaking with you, and I really feel that I made a very good friend in the process.
Yes, definitely. Friends for life, Tisha. Friends for life. Okay, we're going to do a quick fire round.
Perfect. Go for it.
You will probably tell me things that I've never known before. Beach or city holiday?
And beach. So,
where?
New Caledonia, where my husband's from.
Okay, so can you tell us where that is? Because I didn't know that before this morning. I did not know where New Caledonia is.
New Caledonia is a small little island in the shape of a baguette off the coast of Australia.
Oh, wow. And you see, this is what I was talking about, the full circle moment, because not only did you speak French as a young person, you lived in Australia, you then meet a husband at Harvard Business School who also is from, you know, the same
area, yeah, as you.
That is a full circle moment if ever there was one. Okay, favorite place to visit?
Paris.
Mine too! I love that, Tisha. We need to go together. Apple or orange?
Apple.
Okay. Pizza topping of choice?
Mushrooms.
Just plain?
Yeah, just mushrooms.
Oh, nice. Favorite drink? Don't say water.
No, I'm not going to say water. I'm going to say black coffee.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Okay. How many coffees do you drink?
Just the one. Okay. I'm disciplined, but I need that black coffee.
In the morning?
No, after lunch.
Oh, really?
Yeah, to stay awake.
What time do you get up to go to the boxing?
4:45 in the morning.
That's where successions are made, I guess. Thank you so much, Tisha, for
Thank
your
you
time
so much,
on
Jerry.
The podcast. And I'm really, really glad to have met you
and
to share this time with you. You're an excellent guest and excellent CEO.
Thank you so much.
No one would contradict that. So you've been excellent. Thanks.
Thanks, Jerry.
This has been an excellent podcast. And today is actually my dad's 80th birthday. Much like Tisha, I've learned so much from him. And I just wanted to say, happy birthday, Papa. We love you. Everyone, we'll see you next month. Take care.